and welcome back to NeuroQual, our qualitative resource for neurosurgeons and neurosurgery. This is an introduction to Unit 2, where we start to talk a bit more about the benefits of qualitative research, why we would choose to use qualitative research, our experience of choosing qualitative methods, and then a bit of the intricacies around sample and sample size. So just as a reminder, I'm Charlie Whiffin, and with me today are...
Hi, I'm San or Santhony, whichever you want to call me.
And I'm Brendan.
We've got to get more slick at introducing ourselves. So we've all used qualitative research, some have done how many projects? So Brendan, this is your first project, although you were involved in the project that I was doing as well. So tell me, how many qualitative projects have you done?
This would be the second one.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Second one then. And a proper one. I've done one. It wasn't really proper, but
I love that. That idea that you've done qualitative before, but it wasn't really proper qualitative. Have you decided that it wasn't proper qualitative, having kind of done all of this stuff that we've done together there on the training?
Exactly. Yes. I was fooled into thinking that was qualitative.
Brilliant. So let's just have a think about, well, why did you first decide to use qualitative research? Because I think you've told me before it wasn't really your decision.
No. I think there were two reasons. One is that when I first joined this group, for instance, they didn't have any qualitative work going on. So they wanted...
That's the NIHR Global Health.
My health group on neurotrauma research. So yes, they didn't have anything. So they thought, why don't I incorporate that into my project? So that was like the big reason. And as I tried to develop the protocol and the proposal for the project, I realized, yes, I can actually use qualitative, because if I want to talk to people on the ground, that is the only way I can do it. It's no point giving them a survey saying, is this, that, is that, that, because you don't get the contextual detail. Yeah. You don't get the local perspective or experience of that particular issue, which in my case was road traffic collisions and resulting neurotrauma from the road traffic collision.
Yeah, I think I've just written it down, context and local perspective. And I think if you're, like, if you were doing a questionnaire, for example, the problem with a questionnaire is you really have to know this, you know, what it is you're trying to find out. And then you only kind of find out the things that you've decided at the beginning what you want to find out. But so it's really kind of narrow, isn't it? So, and the researcher decides what they want to look at, and then the survey is then generally used to quantify how often those things occur. Yeah. Whereas qualitative research, you kind of start from more humble beginnings, don't you, with actually, I don't know enough about this subject matter, yes, or the evidence base isn't evolved enough to know enough about this subject matter, or actually, I'm not the best person to understand this subject area. So, and I think that kind of that position of kind of, like I say, being humble about this topic makes you more open to what you might find out, you know, so it's that point of wanting to explore a subject and, you know, to go in and think about and look for those contexts or those nuances that you possibly would never have thought about if you'd have just, you know, looked at the literature to design a questionnaire. Why do you think, given the group is really positivist, you know, because what they're doing, and rightly so, they're trying to drive improvement in outcomes and improvement in care. So why do you think yours was the first project that they kind of decided to bring qualitative research into?
This is my take on it, and I could be completely and utterly wrong. But it's because mine was a, mine is a public health project. And I think a lot of times neurosurgeons and clinicians think that public health is a social science, which it is in some sense, but there's also other aspects to it. So yeah. I think that was why they sort of went, okay, public health, yes, we can use qualitative for it. So I think that was the thinking. And again, as I said, I could be, I've completely missed the plot, but that's really what I think was the motivation for getting qualitative into my project.
Mm. That's really interesting. We just said about the link to social sciences, and that's not something that we touched upon in the first podcast. But actually, you know, I think whereas, you know, there's a need for neuroqual, because actually this is quite an emerging evidence base within medicine. But actually, we didn't really talk about the fact that actually qualitative research has been around for a long time. You know, and it's really well evolved in certain disciplines, certainly the social sciences. And also, if you look at allied health as well, you know, my background is nursing. You know, we've been doing qualitative research for a long time. And actually, it kind of feels a little bit like medicine is kind of catching up with that wave, you know, and actually realizing that not all questions can be answered through a positivist lens. Not all important things can be measured. And then looking at projects where qualitative would enhance quantitative results, and putting those things together. So it's really exciting to be part of that journey within this particular discipline. So Brandon, tell me a bit about, or tell the listeners a bit about your journey into qualitative, and why qualitative for your project.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange journey into it, really, because when I was initially starting the project, I never thought of that it would be qualitative heavy, so to speak. So I thought mixed methods, okay, that's fine. Maybe a small qualitative project at the start. This is at a time where I didn't really know what qualitative was, to sort of lay the groundwork. Yeah, I mean, now two years in, and not having started the other part of the mixed methods project, it's the data that we've gotten, I think, would have been more than if I had managed to do five smaller quantitative surveys.
Mm.
Because of the topic being the contextual challenges of follow-up in these low resource settings, and because it's not a well-established, I suppose, there's not enough literature on this subject already, at least not in the field of neurosurgery, it would be really difficult to have constructed a survey that would have given us the same result as the qualitative project has given us. Because I think that because we didn't know what the opinions would be and what the challenges would be, by making a survey or something similar and just disseminating that, we'd have really boxed in the chances to get some really rich, really rich data that we've managed to do through the interviews. Because even in free text responses, you're still not necessarily biasing. Biasing is probably the wrong word, but you're asking for something specific. And I think the participants will give you something specific.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that they would have given you something else that you wouldn't have wanted. Mm. And at least we know for any surveys, you know, there's almost an element of survey fatigue now, and it's very difficult to get these long, lengthy responses that you'd normally get from, say, a conversation or an interview that you can do in qualitative research. So it's been a bit of an interesting journey getting into it, but having gone through it now, once you do the project, once you get that data set and you get your interviews or transcripts or any other qualitative data set, you really do appreciate the richness of it.
Mm.
And, you know, just this, the depth that the data gives you. And it's almost like if I had to do it quantitatively, I would imagine I would need hundreds of responses or have had to do so many surveys of one after another, slowly chipping away at what, you know, the challenges of this long-term follow-up would actually be. Whereas even doing, I mean, in the project, we managed to get 18 participants for the qualitative interviews. And the amount of data has brought so many tangents and so many new avenues, and has really laid a strong foundation for, as you say, further, more focused, refined, quantitative surveys perhaps, now that we know what you know this reality looks like in these low resource settings. So it really does help build that first foundation when you don't really know much about the area that you're trying to explore. So yeah, if we're going to bring back the metaphor of a box, quantitative methods, you have your box, you have your well-defined box. And I think the qualitative is similar to a box. You still have some structure, but there's a box of holes in it. So you have, you know, there's lots of opportunity to go away from that agenda that you've set and to really explore what these participants are thinking about, you know, the challenges that they're facing. So, and you know, again, the box changes, and as you get these participants' responses, you can change that, you know, interview schedule, or you know what would be in quantitative methods, that you know your survey, you can rapidly change it as you receive the responses, which just isn't done in quantitative. So it's a very adaptable research methodology, I think.
I'm going to pick up on some of the things you said because they're really important. I think the first one I just want to emphasize is that idea of rich data. So one of the main characteristics that people talk about in qualitative methods is that opportunity to get rich, contextual, individualized, and in-depth responses. And you're right, when you put we see it all the time in the literature where people have used what they call qualitative questionnaires, and they have their place, and there's no problem with that. But actually, I know myself, when I fill out a free text answer, generally speaking, I want that to be over as quickly as possible. So I really limit that response. So if somebody says, you know, please elaborate, I might put, I don't know, if you want to elaborate on your emotion today. So my emotion or my general well-being today, again, I've got a cold, not COVID, cold. You know, my Likert score might be a 6, and they say, oh, please elaborate, and it just says I've got a cold. Whereas if you ask me about my general well-being, I'll probably give you a story about, you know, how it's going on in my family, how it's all working, see the transmission, what's been going on. So there's all this other stuff that you get. And I think it depends on, again, your research position and what you want. But you could either decide that all that contextual information is kind of dross. Well, I hate this word, but this idea of dross. So it's unfocused information, and it's not about the thing that you're interested in. Or actually, it's really rich context to help you understand that person's response and that person's perspective. And a lot of qualitative research is trying to get at that individual perspective, because we all have. We come back to this idea of multiple realities. You know, we're all on this call, but on this podcast, but we're all actually having a very different lived experience of it, depending on our background, our comfort zone, you know, what we want to say, you know. So actually the reality of what's going on here is very, very different. And that's all really rich information and can help us to understand that viewpoint or that experience or that phenomena in far more depth than is usually possible with a questionnaire. I mean, I have seen some really good examples of, one example was a researcher looked at birth trauma narratives. And before I had children, this put me off children completely. I was like, I'm never going to have kids. but it was, they asked women to write stories, kind of unsolicited sort of stories about their birth trauma. And actually, I think in that study, because it wasn't responding to a question, it just said to write your own narrative. And they just wrote these stories about their birth trauma. I think in that study, actually, that approach was really good, and it really elicited rich contextual data. So I think there are ways of getting, you know, richer storied accounts than simply, you know, expand on your answer. But again, it goes back to what research question do you want to answer. And if your research question is really narrow, so you just want to find out a little bit about people's attitudes towards you know, virtual outpatient appointments, you know, that, you know, you might not need a really in-depth you know, qualitative approach, because you have a reasonable assumption about what you're going to find out. And the study that I have done for the group on neurosurgeons' experiences of conducting clinical research, I was really aware that You know, I was brought in as a qualitative researcher to do this study, not a neurosurgeon, not from an LMIC. And the idea that I could create a questionnaire, I mean, not that this was ever suggested, but just the idea that I could do a quantitative study on a subject that I really don't know anything about was actually is really, you know, it's kind of naive, you know, that you would, because you just couldn't do that. You just wouldn't have a proper, full, in-depth understanding of the phenomena to do that. And even now I've done the study, I still wouldn't be able to do it because there's so many, you know, differences within the LMIC landscape that actually you need all of that rich contextual information to kind of bring it alive and to actually understand the problem beyond that surface layer. So I think we've all been drawn, some kicking and screaming, to qualitative research. But again, we go back to this, you know, this idea of, I think it's really important to the evidence base that we do have ways of inquiry methods that are beyond outcome measures. I mean, what do you guys think about, you know, the need for qualitative, specifically in, you know, in neurosurgery, in medicine? Like, what do you think is valuable?
Yes, I do. And this is coming from someone with a medical background who wasn't introduced to qualitative research until really, really down the line. And it brings me back to a study that I did as a first year medical student decades ago, well, maybe a decade and a half ago. And this was looking at how, because I studied in a big hospital, the Central Hospital in Kuala Lumpur, and it was the referral center for pediatric oncology patients. So we were looking at how parents who lived outside the capital actually coped with the fact that they had to be referred to the hospital. And, you know, they had to think about where to stay, how to pay for this and that and the other. So the irony is that it was a perfect qualitative study question. How do parents cope? And yet we did that as a survey. And now when I think about it, it actually makes me cringe. And I think one of the reasons why it ended up that way is because, again, in medicine, at least at that time, qualitative research was virtually unheard of.
Mm.
Like, if I want to find out how you feel about something, like exactly what you said earlier, I'll just give you a Likert scale. I'll just give you a tick box. Do you feel this? Yes. Do I feel that? No. Where do you get your money from? Friends, family, just tick, 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 whichever one. But I think like what Brandon pointed out, the richness is not there.
Mm.
There's absolutely nothing. It's just superficial information. And when you talk about things like coping or perceive or experience, you really want to know how that is, how it feels, the lived experience, the lived perception, the lived coping. Mm. Yeah. So again, it's a bit sad that wasn't there at that time, but I'm hoping now, I think it is becoming better, even in LMICs. I mean, Malaysia is considered LMIC, but yeah, it is getting there, and hopefully with this work that we are doing, it will expand to more LMICs.
Mm. I think it's just about, you know, increasing interest and respect. You know, I think, you know, there are journals, not so much now, but you know, just didn't publish qualitative research because it's not as citable or it's not as impactful. But I think there's something about qualitative research which, you know, it's certainly more demanding. But I think for me anyway, research is a learning experience. So if I pick up, you know, if I pick up you know, a quantitative paper, and you know, if we look at coping strategies of parents or something like that, and there's a list of, you know, who provides them with finance, or how many minutes it took them to get to the hospital, or, you know, the time it took to discharge or something like that, it kind of leaves me really cold, and I kind of feel, you know, I've learned something, you know, but it doesn't change the core of what I think or my practice. And I think there's something about qualitative research that demands that you make sense of it, even more than what's on the page. So there's, you know, that idea that you write your find, you do your analysis, you write about it, but also the reader is reading your analysis and trying to make sense of your findings as well. There's kind of like this secondary interpretive process going on. So it kind of doesn't end just at your dissemination. And I think as a practitioner, I think that's immensely powerful, because it's not generalizability. It's not like saying, okay, well, this sample was these people, and I never met those people, so I can't change my practice. But there's something about, actually, I met Mrs. Jones the other day, and that's similar to what was going on here. And I'd never thought about it in that way. I never thought of asking her that question. I never thought about how she might feel when I said this to her. And I think that's, for me, that communicative power to draw practice. So I think that's why it's so useful for the evidence base, because it demands that we think in a slightly different way. What do you think? What are your thoughts, Brandon?
No, I agree with the whole the thoughts about generalizability. It's, I don't think qualitative methods is meant to, you know, speak on behalf of sort of the population as you can get in quantitative. You know, you can sort of extrapolate from a small sample size and assume it's the same for everybody. I think having that second layer, you know, the layer of interpretation, so you don't just go from, you know, methods to results to discussion. I think having that, you know, the research having their own interpretation. I mean, I'm only limited to thematic analysis, but having that coding process and sort of beginning to understand what the data might mean, and tying all of these opinions of and perspectives of the participants together into one bigger narrative. I don't think you can achieve the same, you know, again, come back to richness as you can in quantitative, because you just can't, it really is, it's more deeper. It's so much less superficial than quantitative sort of can achieve, at least from my particular project and my, you know, understanding of it in hindsight, and how it could, how it might work other ways if I had to do it again. It's, I don't think it's meant to be generalizable. It's going to provide a snapshot of those particular people with that particular research at that particular time. And I think it just being a contribution and, you know, addressing something that wasn't addressed before is, you know, is a really good thing. I mean, if someone done the project the same as me, exactly the same participants, same time, same year, but as a different researcher, I'd expect perhaps slightly different results, but it would be useful to see those results.
Absolutely.
Because again, you can combine those results together like you would do in quantitative, and you can get these things like meta-analysis or these larger understandings of things. Yeah. And I think it serves it well, because you're bringing people back into the research, which they're very much lost in things like surveys and number data. So you really do lose it when you're trying to get, you know, perspectives and opinions. It's hard to define those two simple tick box questions or scale questions. You really do need to get them talking and have that rapport with them. You can't really have rapport with the survey.
No
matter who the survey could be for.
And actually, you don't want it in a survey, because the whole idea is that it's an objective, you know, repeatable, valid. It's the tool that collects data, and nothing to do with the research, or it's not supposed to have anything to do with research.
You are the research yourself by adding in your own interpretation of what the participants are saying and having the transcripts of them. It's a really unique field of research, and I think that anything involving people would, you know, is going to benefit greatly from this, because again, you're bringing it back into the equation and really showing what the actual reality of these situations can be, especially in the context of global health. It's you know, having that personal connection with them, and bringing your own experiences in to the dialogue, and, you know, and comparing is really interesting.
I think what you said there was really important, and you didn't use this word, but that's what I wrote down: marginalized voices. Qualitative research is really good for empowering, you know, stakeholders, the underrepresented, the hidden, you know, those voices that we don't normally hear. And quantitative quite often deals with the most, the many, you know, the average, you know, and doesn't always think about those outliers. And actually, it's the outliers that quite often inform the average, and tell us, you know, far more interesting, important information. And, you know, I think one of the things about, you know, I'm very new to global health, so you guys can jump in any time, but, you know, it's that sense of, I think in research, certainly that is, you know, heavily dominated by a high income country type perspective. You know, we design the outcome measures and translate them into other languages. We decide on, or typically historically have decided on, the research questions and the focus. And I think quite often, and we go back to this idea of this kind of coming from a more humble position, that actually if you kind of meet participants as equals and say, hey, I don't know enough about this, tell me, you know, tell me what your life is like, tell me what your circumstances are like, help me understand it so I can tell other people. You kind of put yourself in a position where you're like, you know, a middleman in between, you know, the sample, the population, and actually the people who are trying to help, and that evidence base. And, you know, there are more and more kind of participatory approaches that are coming, especially kind of in global health, where, you know, that blur the boundaries between the traditional, the participants and the researcher. And actually these participatory approaches are, you know, where the participants are also the researchers. I think that's really exciting. There are more approaches that are kind of inclusive of like arts approaches, using art to kind of express, and photography to express kind of lives and understand. And so there's more mediums in which to think about individual lives and perspectives. And I think that kind of takes us on to one of the figures that I drew for this unit, which, what's the figure? Let's have a look. So it's towards the end, that's it. So it's figure two, and it's the continuum of qualitative research. Now, I'm kind of expecting anybody who knows a bit about qualitative research who gets to this stage to probably argue that that's not right. but I struggled so much to actually draw something that was vaguely representative of the qualitative field, because there are so many different ways to do qualitative research. And we go back to this idea, I think we said in the first podcast, that from an outside perspective, it looks like we all do the same thing. We generally have a chat to people, we make some themes up, and that's it. but actually, when you get into the field, you realise that there are so many different ways that you can do qualitative research. And that then determines how you sample, how you analyze, you know, you frame your research questions in slightly different ways. So, you know, I tried to draw something that would suggest that there is, and on a basic level, there is like a continuum of qualitative research. On one end are qualitative approaches, which are more like a kind of traditional kind of almost quantitative. So how many times do people talk about anxiety? Okay, 6. Great. Okay, well, that's how many times do they talk about being stressed? Okay, 72. Okay, so we know that stress is a more important concept than anxiety in this data set. So there are ways of doing qualitative research that kind of count the presence of certain items. It's absolutely fine. Traditional content analysis would do that. And I think that would sit down at one end of this continuum, which is kind of closer to what might be more traditional in kind of quantitative research. And then if we fly all the way down to the bottom end, there are really interpretive, highly individual, you know, perspectives about construction of reality and sense making, and you know, this social construction of our realities and multiple meanings. And that it's a bit like a rabbit warren, and a lot of these approaches are deeply informed by philosophy. So if we go back to unit one, where we started to think about philosophy, but, you know, if you take something like phenomenology, for example, I don't know if you guys have looked at all at phenomenology or kind of read about it. Brandon's shaking his head. No. For the people listening, you can't see that. So have you come across phenomenology?
I have, but if I'm being honest, it's not something I've actually delved into, so please go ahead.
Yeah. So phenomenology, for people who've never come across it, it's a particular type of methodology. So a particular type of way of doing research. And it's all about the lived experience. But it's deeply philosophically based and originated in German philosophers, Heidegger and Husserl. And it has evolved from a descriptive kind of lived experience to an interpretive. So there are different, even within phenomenology, there are different schools. So there's a descriptive school and there's an interpretive school. And then even within interpretive phenomenology, there's another sub-branch called interpretive phenomenological analysis, IPA, by Smith, Flowers and Larkin. And actually, people within interpretive phenomenology, there are some people who don't even think IPA is real. So there are all these arguments, and they don't think it's a school of phenomenology at all. So there's a lot of all these arguments going on, which I love. Like, it's really interesting. As somebody trying to learn, it's a nightmare. You know, when you try and understand it and talk to people about it, not everybody agrees. And I think phenomenology in particular is a bit like a rabbit warren. It's amazing, but it has all of these really in-depth structures that you really have to understand if you're going to use that approach. But if you wanted to look particularly at somebody's lived experience of like living with cancer, for example, or, you know, living with a chronic illness or something like that, phenomenology is a really good way of doing it, because it really does ask you to think about that individual lived experience. And then you use that individual lived experience to understand maybe other people's experiences. And then another kind of out there, if you like, approach, like grounded theory. So grounded theory came around from a kind of rebuttal to this airy-fairy, you know, non kind of systematic analysis that we qualitative researchers seem to be doing. And Glaser and Strauss kind of said, well, we need to be more systematic in our data analysis. We need to be far more, we need to work through the, break the data down more constructively. We need to rebuild it. And we actually need to do something with it, because qualitative researchers are lazy, essentially, because they just come up with a bunch of themes and kind of go home. Whereas actually the themes aren't that helpful. If we could make the data turn into theory, then theory can help us. Theory can actually inform, you know, practice. So the idea of grounded theory was that it builds theory. But even within grounded theory, there are several other schools of grounded theory, different types. So there was Glaser and Strauss started it, and then they, I don't know if they had a falling out, but then Strauss and Corbin came later and kind of did something else. And then you have Kathy Sharmes did social constructivist grounded theory. So again, there's this kind of other layers of different types of research. And then obviously you've got ethnography, and then you've got narrative, which I've done. And case study is quite nice because it kind of looks at the bounded systems, but it's so hard to try and represent all of those different schools within this, you know, this continuum. So don't know, I mean, I don't know if you guys have had a look at that or what you think to the different varieties of different approaches, and how deep is deep enough in your analysis, or the types of choices you had available. Do you want to talk about that?
Anyway. I mean, I've seen many, many different diagrams of people trying to demonstrate these continuums, but it all seems like, because there is so many diagrams, I mean, I've seen one that has continuums. So you've got these spectrums, these two arrows on either end. And then on either side, you have things like for one for ontology, one for like epistemology, you know, methodology and methods and so on and so forth. And it seems that there's a lot of dimensions, and it's very hard to represent something with lots of dimensions, you know, in this two dimensional way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, you may be situated on, you know, close to the interpretivist side, and you're going to use your, you know, qualitative methods to find out. So that, well, that's two axes. So you've got to position yourself on that. But then you've got to also fit in your ontology as well, which adds another axis, and then you've got three axis already, and then you've got to also think about your epistemology and you know, any methods you're going to use, and it soon becomes something you can't visualize.
Yeah, that's a really good
because it's very much it's hard to do. It's really hard to do, and obviously these things will change over time and will become different things. I mean, you have thematic analysis, now you have reflexive thematic analysis, and you know, you have constructivism, and then you also have interpretists, and it's you know, sometimes they're overlapped or the same thing, and the language changes as well, so it's very hard to define it. But I think as long as you are sort of defining it, and you are saying why you think you're this, or I think then that you really are pushing the narrative forwards and doing proper qualitative research.
I think it's that idea of being transparent about what you're doing and how you understand key terms. So, you know, even I've often found where I've read textbooks and different textbooks say different things, even for a definition of epistemology. So, and that one defines it in one way, one defines it in another way, one defines it in the same way as ontology. And you're like, well, how? It drives you mad. And I think what's useful when you are comparing the different approaches, there's several textbooks and papers as well, which in a table form, they would have like in the columns on one, like down the left-hand side, they would put epistemology, ontology, methodology, methods. And then they would have a column for phenomenology, a column for grounded theory, a column for narrative. And they would at least show you how those different studies are normally designed if you want to create something that looks like that. And I think that's one of the things that's really important, actually, and what I look for when I'm reviewing a journal paper is if a study decides to call itself grounded theory, there are certain things that I would expect a grounded theory study to include, like certain strategies, and it's same with narrative. So I would expect certain things. So it is really important that if you do sign up to one of these particular methodologies, that you do understand the methods for which that involves. And they are quite prescriptive. So it's a bit like, I always use baking analogies with students in that, you know, if the book you want, you know, if the cake you want to create is a Black Forest gatto, and you decide not to put in the core ingredients that make it a Black Forest gatto, you'll create a nice cake, but it won't be what you said it is. So, and I think that's the same kind of for methodology. If you call it phenomenology, you have to do certain things that make it phenomenology, and if you don't do those things, then it's not really, it's still kind of qualitative, but it's not phenomenology, and you won't have done what phenomenology expects you to do. And I think that's why RTA is quite, reflective thematic analysis is quite useful, because it doesn't have so many rules about what you have to do. There's that flexibility. It's still very much within, you know, the qualitative thinking and qualitative philosophy, but it's not prescriptively rigid in the methods that you need to include. I know we're going to do another podcast on RTA, so we'll probably leave that there for that. But what about different choices for you, Stan? Do you think that continuum is useful? Do you think that's hard to understand? Or do you already want to argue about it with me?
No, I think if you look at that continuum on figure two, for someone who's very new to qualitative research, I think they would appreciate having that. On the other hand, it might be a bit misleading because they might think that's just how it is. So This is that. So I say that because I'm using framework analysis in my current work, and there have been lots of debates on where framework analysis should actually sit.
Yeah,
I do agree with you that it is in my context, it is where it should be. What I'm doing is a descriptive study, so it is in the right position being there. But there are some people who say that it's not, although it's not a theoretically informed way of doing qualitative research, it's just a method. So the method has nothing to do with the ontology or epistemology. It can be something. I think there's one paper I read, the lady who wrote it said it sits within the subtle realism. She felt that that's where it should be situated. But then there are some people who don't even say anything about it. They just only used framework analysis and that's it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's this difficulty of like, what we've been talking about, the need to explain, to be transparent about what you're doing. And yes, going back to your original question about what I think, yes, I think it is very helpful, but I think it should be also taken with a pinch of salt so that people don't think this is it. Mm-hmm. This is true for anything that's been written in the units as well, because we have pointed out repeatedly that qualitative work is not something that's like a p-value, that's how it is, or a chi-square test, that's how it is. It evolves, it changes to and fro, back and forth, and that's a very important thing to understand. This is just to facilitate understanding.
Yeah. That's so important that you said that, but as an author that's really difficult. And as somebody trying to learn, it's even worse, because you as soon as you write something, it's kind of fixed, it's so hard to tell somebody, like to teach somebody about something, and then after you've taught them that concept, pull that rug out and say, actually, it's not really like that. We don't really do it like that. It's so difficult. It's so challenging. And I think that's why quite often qualitative researchers, you'll find that we stick to our own, the bits that we really understand, so the bits that we understand well and where we feel really comfortable. I mean, it's taken me, so I'm really comfortable now with narrative inquiry and hopefully reflective thematic analysis. But I'd really like to know more about framework analysis. I'd really like to have a go at a study that does framework analysis, just so that I understand how different it is to the stuff that I've been doing. But actually, I really struggle with the idea of framework analysis, because I kind of feel like I will still be sucking myself into the more interpretive work that I am more comfortable with. And it's the same with there's some new stuff coming on board around rapid qualitative research. And so there's some interesting work going on there. And I've just joined a group more because I've always said qualitative research takes time. It needs time. It's like a fine wine. It needs to develop. You need to think about it. And here are these guys doing rapid qualitative research. So what does that mean? What does it look like? How different is it? What are they missing? Are they missing anything? So it's a bit like, these young whippersnappers coming coming onto the scene and kind of changing what we would normally traditionally accept as part of the landscape of qualitative research. So I hope that's been a good overview of the unit, really. And I think what San, you were saying is just is to open up that thinking. Students, learners, practitioners, whatever, we shouldn't just be forced to think in a particular way. It's an inquiry mind that we're trying to develop. And you really need that in research. And I guess if you want to do any of these approaches, whether it's framework, content, narrative, certainly for the first time, it's about connecting with an expert. Find somebody who's already done it, find a mentor, find somebody who can help you with it, and read as much as you can. I think that's all I really wanted to say about this unit. What about you guys? Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, I don't think so.
Did we say we were going to cover sampling? We did, didn't we?
Yes. Yes.
So it might just be worthwhile just saying that, sample sizes are always small. Can't get around it. It's just one of those things. And it always makes me laugh, even in, good qualitative research, in a good journal, they've actually done it really well. You get to the limitations and they'll always say it was a really small sample. So it's a bit like saying, well, you can't really believe what we said, it's a really small sample. But like how many people did you have in your qualitative studies, San?
So my previous one, we had 10 each. And this one is probably about 15 for one group. Yeah.
Yeah. Brandon, how many you got in yours? I think you said earlier.
So 18 in this one. 18. But this is well under what we initially planned to get.
Yeah.
Sort of 24 to 48, I think we said. So
But aren't you glad we didn't recruit that up to that number?
I think in pure logistics and not wanting to really make sure that you capture what the data you've been given and present it well, I think that 18, you know, we had all that we could possibly, at least in my eyes, get at this particular occasion. Maybe next time it'd be completely different. Maybe it could be double that and we still wouldn't feel like we've got really captured what we've got. But I think with our with our agenda, with our questions that we wanted to at least find out to set this foundation, I think we managed to do it justice.
Mm. And that's the thing. It's a funny thing, sample size, and you know, journal reviewers always want the sample size to be bigger. And you know, I've heard incidences where you know they won't accept a manuscript in certain journals if your sample size isn't over a certain number. But you know, it's if you the worry is that if you over recruit, then the richness that we started this podcast talking about, you actually don't have the time to really explore that richness. So you've got all this data that people have given you, and you kind of you've got a responsibility to do that analysis properly. But if you over recruit, you can't do that unless you've got a team of researchers looking at the data. So it's always, I think there are some pragmatic decisions to make, other than, you know, leave data saturation to another day. But you know, this just in terms of what resources do you have, what time do you have, what level of depth are you trying to look at? And if we go back to this continuum, quite often the approaches which are more, I don't like using the word superficial because I feel like that's a criticism of those approaches, and it's not. But if you wanted, you know, an approach which is maybe, you know, more descriptive, you know, more sticking with what's in the data rather than kind of what's not in the data or that interpretation of it, you can actually have a larger sample size. So that facilitates a slightly larger sample size because you're not trying to do the same sort of stuff with it. Whereas if you want to do something which is more like the narrative or the phenomenology, really in-depth work, actually your sample sizes come right down again, sometimes single figures, because of that amount of work that you need to do with the data and the different kind of layers of analysis. So again, I think sample size isn't just something that you kind of pluck out the air, but also it's not something that there's no sample size calculator. So it's worth looking at good examples of the type of research you want to emulate. So if you were doing framework, having a look at published framework analysis, I'm sure also there'll be in the textbooks around framework analysis, there will be suggested sample sizes for, you know, what they think is probably reasonable. So it's about being guided by those sorts of things, as well as, you know, what you can reasonably work with. But yeah, we always, you know, we always deal with the small sample sizes, and it's about sort of, maybe it's about being proud of that, you know, and what we get from that rather than seeing it as a limitation of the work. Because I'm actually more concerned by big sample sizes if there isn't a team of researchers to look at that. So yeah, that's probably all I wanted, you know, the other thing that I wanted to mention. Because it is important, but it needs to be, this is where we talk about the methods reflect the methodology. So you need to look at the type of research that you're doing, and again, your research question, and make sure you don't, you know, you have a reasonable sample size and the right amount of data. Because, you know, you can get 6 hours of interviews from five people, or you can have 10 minute interviews with 20 people, you know, you have a similar amount of data. So yeah, it's important to the context behind the sample, I think. All right. Well, on that note, I think I would say enjoy unit two. Starts to become a bit more practical from here on in, really thinking a bit more about, you know, why we do it, how we do it. The next unit coming up is on interviews and some practical advice about holding interviews. So I really enjoyed that conversation with you guys today. So thank you very much for joining us. Sam, do you want to sign off?
So as Charlie said, enjoy the unit, and I hope it will sort of enlighten you on qualitative research a bit more, that you understand what it is and why it's important, especially in neurosurgery, the field of neurosurgery.
Brilliant. Thanks, Sam. Final word from you, Brendan.
Yeah, no, I'd say enjoy the unit and sort of keep an open mind to it with these things. I think it's, especially if you're coming from quantitative research, you have to really sort of learn to let go of these, you know, rigid sample sizes and focus on these big generalizable studies that you can apply to all sorts of populations. I think that, you know, with qualitative, it's very much a vessel of just bringing this reality that you've tried to capture to an audience. So, and just making sure that it's watertight, really, in you know, when you present this research, that people can see that you've took the right measures to ensure that this reality has been presented as it actually was, I suppose. It's to keep an open mind and to enjoy the unit.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining us. And we'll hope to be with you again soon.